Hello, it is March 5th, 2014. This is episode 349 of the Will Leach Experience podcast on Sports on Earth. Today's death, John Belushi, died March 5th, 1982. Belushi met his wife Judy at Wheaton Central High School outside Chicago, and the two moved to New York City to pursue John's comedy career when each was 24 years old. 2 years later, he would join the cast of Saturday Night Live, and 4 years later, he left that show to make movies. He ended up making a total of four more. His drug addiction was legendary, even among a crew of drug addicts, and on the day of his death, he reportedly did cocaine in his hotel room with Robert De Niro and Robin Williams, separately. He died of a fatal speedball injection at the age of 33. The last thing he ever filmed was a cameo in the series Police Squad, which was of course turned into The Naked Gun, as part of a running gag where a special guest star died before the opening credits. He was filmed floating face down in a pool. The footage never aired and is thought to be destroyed. Here in Athens, though, it's really Wednesday. I'm Will Leach. Thank you for spending part of your day with me. A little bit of baseball talk. We're going to go a little bit more heavy into baseball over the next fortnight, as you'd probably expect. But for now, I'm actually pretty happy to have on Chris O'Leary. He is a baseball pitching mechanics expert. I actually quoted him in my story, one of my final features for New York Magazine, which was about how difficult it is to predict pitcher injuries and how it's possible there's just no way to do it at all. And O'Leary doesn't necessarily agree. He thinks that there's a certain sort of pitching motion that you can predict who's going to get hurt. He's going to tell us who is going to get hurt. So fantasy people, get your calculators ready, because people use calculators for fantasy baseball, you see. Anyway, so we're happy to have Chris with me. All right, so Mr. O'Leary, first, thanks for coming on with me. Give the listeners here, because you know I've talked to you before for New York Magazine for my story about pitchers' arms and pitcher injuries. Explain to my audience a little bit, just kind of like how you got into this and how you kind of became an expert in this field.
Well, I at the end of the day, I'm just a dad. I played through grade school, and the bottom line is, I ended up hurting my arm, which got me into the pitching thing because I didn't want what happened to me to happen to my kids. So I started researching pitching and trying to understand why pitchers got hurt. And I ended up having a kid with an arm injury that kind of freaked me out. It turned out he was accidentally throwing a slider, but that got me into the whole mechanics thing. And the more I read about mechanics, the more I realized that the experts didn't, it didn't seem like they knew what they were talking about because everybody was disagreeing with each other. You know, some people would say this is the best possible thing to do. Others would say this is the worst possible thing to do. They couldn't both be right. So I kind of dove into the research. And then, so that's how I got into the pitching stuff. And I've got two boys who pitch. And then I got into the hitting stuff when my older son started having a problem with his hitting, a problem with called bat drag. That got me into the hitting stuff, and I found the same thing with the hitting stuff where everybody was disagreeing, and I just started reading the research and the biomechanics and the physics and looking into, you know, what the best hitters actually do. I started putting together, I'm from St. Louis, so I had Albert Pujols 15 minutes away down at Busch Stadium and started studying Pujols swing and started putting stuff up on the internet just for kind of karmic purposes. You know, I was learning from other people, so I'd put stuff out there so that people could learn from what I'd learned. And a guy named Andres Torres, who was a minor leaguer with the Cubs at the time, this is May of 08, stumbled across my stuff, and I ended up working with him and helped him kind of rebuild his swing and his approach. And then he ended up making it into the major leagues and got a ring with the Giants in 2010. So then I was kind of off on the hitting stuff. So I go back and forth on both the hitting and the pitching stuff. It's kind of a dual interest, but there's a lot of overlap. So
yeah, I'm curious about the overlap. Is it you know, because I when I talked to you, we talked specifically about pitching. Is one harder to harder injury to predict than another? Is there one consistent thing that pitchers do wrong that maybe there's more different things that hitters do wrong? What's the major difference in just kind of analyzing both hitters and pitchers?
Well, to a degree, pitching is simpler mechanically because there are fewer variables. You know, the thing about hitting is you've got the dynamic of the pitcher and what the pitcher's trying to do, and you have to, the hard thing about hitting is you have to adjust to hit you know, multiple pitches. You know, the big question in hitting that I pose to people is, and I tell them to, you know, if you're talking to a hitting guy, the question you need to ask them to see how sophisticated the theory is how do you hit something other than a middle fastball? A lot of guys can't answer that question, and that's what makes hitting complicated. Pitching is a little more straightforward, but the thing about pitching is you get the whole velocity thing, and you know, 99% of the pitching world is men, and men are, you know, if a lot is good, then more is better. So you get into this whole velocity thing, and that's where a lot of the inverted arm action stuff is coming from. Is people are just trying to, you know, if 95 is good, then 96 is better, and that's how we got to where we are in terms of the inverted arm actions and the pitching injuries and those kinds of things.
Yeah, that to me is one of the most fascinating things that I talked to you about before, and when I look at your site now. The notion that, of course, obviously velocity is such, it's the currency, really, when it comes to Major League and Minor League pitching now. But, I think you've made a pretty compelling argument that, you know, there are certain ways to keep your arm, a little bit better and a little bit more healthier. But really, to get to the crazy consistent velocity that people are up to, they almost have to do something wrong.
Generally, yes, especially the way things are being taught. Although one thing I've been doing this off season is really geeking out on Nolan Ryan, especially, trying to figure out what was his secret. And the interesting thing is he did a lot of stuff that people aren't teaching anymore, and he did a lot of stuff that people now would say is problematic. And I would actually argue that coaches are kind of systematically coaching the athleticism out of their pitchers. And to a degree, a lot of this horrible arm action stuff is the result of the unathleticism of pitchers. Essentially, it's this. If you take the lower body out of a pitcher, if you take the lower body and the core out of a pitcher, then all they've got left is their arm. And I see that in a lot of guys, especially guys who've been taught to be relievers and be fast to the plate, linear to the plate. They end up with these horrible, unathletic, linear lower bodies, and then they develop these terrible, terrible arm actions just as a way of compensating and trying to get some velocity. So I'm really going old school, looking at, you know, Nolan Ryan, Jack Morris, you know, lots of the guys who threw hard but were also really durable, and trying to figure out, you know, what did they do, and find out who the kind of the modern contemporaries are, the guys who are doing similar stuff, you know, the Trevor Rosenthal's, Aroldi Chapman, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, see, that's kind of funny, because I think that in the last few years, you know, we've had, I remember when Nolan Ryan kind of started, became the president of the Rangers, and one of the things he kept talking about is like, oh, these guys, they need to, these kids are pampered, and I think he was kind of mocked a little bit by some of maybe the new era people, the sabermetric folks. But do you think there's something to the idea that not so much that you can retrain these guys at 26 or something, but maybe the specialization of this has maybe led to the problem?
I think that has something to do with it. I mean, one thing you have to keep in mind, and I'm going to say this for the listeners, is adults, kids are not small adults. Kids are fundamentally different. So a lot of the stuff that Nolan Ryan's talking about in terms of adult pitchers does not apply to kids. Right. Kids, you have to be careful. You have to, you know, pitch counts, and you have to limit how hard they throw and how much they throw. But when it comes to adults, you do get this kind of virtuous cycle from conditioning. And I don't think it's an accident that in Nolan Ryan's book and in Tom Seaver's book, both those guys spend a lot of time talking about conditioning, and they were kind of freaks about conditioning. And it's not crazy stuff, you know, maxing out bench presses, that kind of stuff, but they were very well conditioned. And, you know, Dr. Mike Marshall, who's very controversial, but I do think he's right about, you know, you have to be in shape, and the better shape you're in, the better you're going to be able to throw. And Leo Mazzoni did the same thing, you know, with the Braves. They threw more than most people did, and his guys were in good shape, and I think that had something to do with their longevity, especially, you know, in the face of some problematic arm actions and the, you know, in Smoltz and, you know, those kinds of guys.
Yeah, let's talk about the problematic arm actions a little bit. I remember you completely freaked me out when I was doing this story this first time, because I'm somewhat known for being a Cardinals fan, and you freaked me out about Shelby Miller a little bit. You make me feel better about Trevor Rosenthal. But I'm curious, talk specifically, there's always the notion of the inverted W and so on. When we talk about some of the bad arm actions, I want to ask you about some of the guys that you see that have some poor ones. But I'm curious, like, what is the most common mistake that people make arm action-wise?
Well, it depends. In the past, it would be, up until the past couple of years, it'd be elbow lifting, breaking the hands with the elbows. That's how you get into the inverted W, inverted L kind of thing. What I'm seeing more nowadays is I think people are wising up to the elbow lifting stuff and how that's bad. But what I'm seeing a lot of now is keeping the fingers on top of the ball for a long time, showing the ball to center field, pronating too much and too early. That's the kind of stuff that's what got Matt Harvey. I would argue that's what got Matt Harvey. That's what's going to get Shelby Miller. Ivan Nova is another guy who does some of that stuff. And the worst thing is a lot of this is what people are being taught, the show the ball to center field, fingers on top of the ball, pronate early. A lot of that is what people are being taught, and people are saying that it's going to reduce the risk of injury, but I would argue that it's going to increase the risk of injury.
Well,
you're not doing it right.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting, of course, is it seems like, you know, I find the argument that inevitably, if people fix one thing, they're going to have to compensate with it somewhere else in a lot of ways. Because it feels like the notion for what ideal form is seems to change with whatever the new trend is. I mean, of course, you remember, as we all do, the reason that Mark Pryor was such a shock is everyone kept telling us, oh, no, he's got the perfect body and the perfect form for throwing, and then very quickly realized, no, that was completely wrong. He had the worst part for it. And I'm curious, is there, like, when you look at a guy like Nolan Ryan, is there a consistent thing that he did, or was it just body stuff? Is there someone pitching now that has the perfect form that you think more people should emulate?
Well, I mean, my rule of thumb is I'm not going to be interested in a guy unless he's been durable for 10 to 15 years. At 10 years, you're going to start getting my attention. At 15 years, I'm definitely going to take a look at you. But if you look at the guys who are at the top of the list, these are guys who have gone for a long time. You know, Nolan Ryan, Jack Morris, Rick Sutcliffe, you know, current guys that have been around for a while that I think have a chance. Justin Verlander, Cliff Lee, Yovani Gallardo. There's some younger guys, Trevor Rosenthal with the Cardinals, Michael Wacha with the Cardinals, Homer Bailey with the Reds interests me, although he's a younger guy. Jeff Locke with the Pirates is an interesting guy. Those are the guys who I see doing, you know, and Aroldis Chapman does a lot of the same stuff as Nolan Ryan, although he takes it to 11, you know, which is obviously that's where some of the risk comes from. If you're throwing 105, you don't have any margin for error. But I see a lot of guys doing the same basic stuff that Nolan Ryan did, you know, embodying the same basic stuff, the same stuff that Tom Seaver did. I would argue that there's a reason why these guys were, why they were long-lived, and they tend to, the long-lived guys tend to converge on kind of a common pattern. The, you know, pattern that you can see in guys like Bob Gibson, and, you know, seeing, there are lots of Hall of Famers. Koufax is another guy, although he had some stuff that kind of confounded his case.
So when you look at someone now, someone pitching now, that you see their form and you see their workload or whatever combinations come together to make you concerned, who's a pitcher now or a couple pitchers you look at and you're like, okay, that person is Tommy John waiting to happen or something or labrum or whatever problem they may have. Who do you kind of see as like the ticking time bombs?
Well, I mean, guys that are at the top of the list, you know, Zach Wheeler has got an ugly arm action, lower body, although it's interesting because his timing's not horrible. It seems like someone's working with him. Basically, all the Nationals relievers are really problematic, Drew Storen, Craig Stammen. I'm not a fan of Gio Gonzalez. I don't understand how he's lasted as long as he has. Adam Wainwright's an inverted W guy. I think the Tommy John surgery actually bought him a couple of years because it gave, you know, essentially it gave his shoulder a year to heal up, but Wainwright's a high-risk guy. Kimbrel's a high-risk guy. I think it's a good move to make him a closer. I think he's got a chance of lasting as a closer. You know, kind of following the Billy Wagner model of kind of problematic arm action, but if you kind of minimize the workload, minimize the innings, you got a chance of stretching him out. Matt Cain's an elbow lifter who's always made me nervous. Max Scherzer's kind of interesting because he's got a timing problem. He's an elbow lifter. He's been more durable than I thought he would, but I would not, you know, I think he's coming up with free agency. I wouldn't give him a long-term deal, you know, 2 to 3 years, something like that. In terms of the inverted L guys, you got Masahiro Tanaka with the Yankees, the new guy.
So you've seen him. You saw him pitch. Well, he's such a mystery. What have you noticed about him?
He's in some ways, he's similar to Yu Darvish. Yu Darvish is a bit of a mystery to me because he's an elbow lifter, although Darvish has got a great lower body. Tanaka seems to me to be kind of a pale imitation of Darvish. The upper body isn't as good. The lower body isn't as good. The stuff and the release point isn't as good. It's interesting. I'm not as high. I'm somewhat mystified by Darvish, although I think his lower body is really helping him out. Tanaka, I'm not as optimistic about. You know, there are other elbow lifters out there. You know, Linscombe is still elbow lifting. Josh Johnson, Jordan Zimmerman. This time last year, I was talking about Josh Beckett and how I couldn't believe that he hadn't fallen apart yet, and he finally did.
Right,
and I think Beckett's going to be on the same. He's got the same basic problem, inverted L, as Chris Carpenter. He's based on the Chris Carpenter plan, where he's going to be, you know, up and down, and you know, and then we're seeing kind of a new set of problems. Jaime Garcia's having problems, and he's actually kind of interesting because there's this school of thought, kind of put forth by Mike Marshall, that if getting the arm up late is a problem, then let's get the arm up really early, but from what I'm seeing in those guys, that's not a solution. You have to get the arm up on time. Because if you look at arm up early guys like Jaime Garcia, Freddie Garcia, Tommy Hansen, Jason Mott, those guys, they're still having the problems, and I would argue it's because they're getting their arm up too early, that they're introducing a break in the kinetic chain, and they're not as efficient. The thing I'm learning from Nolan Ryan, and the thing that I'm blown away from Nolan Ryan and Jack Morris and Tom Henke, is how good their timing is. Their arm isn't early, it isn't late, it's right on time.
So, and I'm curious, you know, you mentioned earlier the idea of, like, you might not give a long-term contract to a couple of these guys. You know, there's still, it's funny, with all the different ways from the crude way of the way the Nationals handled Steven Strasburg, and to maybe some people letting people go even farther, it feels like in a lot of ways, part of me throws up my hands and be like, you know what? Pitching is really unnatural and weird, and people are just going to get hurt doing it. Like, would you give a long-term contract to any pitcher? Are there people that you would trust that you're like, okay, that person, barring a freak injury, of course, getting their hand broken by a fastball or something. But, like, are there people that you like, you're like, okay, I think that person is going to be healthy for the next 10 years.
I think there are guys that it's a risk-reward thing, and it's a continuum. You know, I think that, you know, Waka's a guy I would lock down sooner. Rosenthal's a guy I would lock down sooner. You know, I liked Ryan Dempster. You know, Cliff Lee, I think, is smart, and he's got amazing command. The biggest thing I'm trying to figure out is just, you know, well, and the biggest thing is, when we make these decisions, let's make them on an informed basis. If we know a guy's a risk, like, my concern with the Nationals is that they have tons and tons and tons of risk in their rotation. Same thing, you know, Blue Jays seem to accumulate tons of risk. There's nothing wrong with having, and the thing about the Cardinals is that the Cardinals, to me, seem to be accumulating a lot of risk. There's nothing wrong with having a little bit of risk. It's like investing, you know. You're not going to make any money if you don't have a risk in your portfolio, but you don't want to have a completely risky portfolio. You know, you need to have a balance of a Ryan Dempster, a Cliff Lee, and then balance that out with a Steven Strasburg. My concern with the Nationals and the Blue Jays is that they're too heavy on risk. You know, they've got three or four risky guys when they really shouldn't have more than one or two. The Cardinals are right on the edge of that. I would actually put Rosenthal in the rotation and put Miller as the closer, you know, or as a setup guy. I understand the war arguments, but, you know, a rotation with Wainwright, Miller, Joe Kelly, that's a even Lance Lynn to a degree, that's a fairly risky rotation. Now, the nice thing is the Cardinals have the depth to be able to go down to that. They've got guys behind that, but my concern is from a risk ratio, the Cardinals are a little overloaded. And I think the Nationals are definitely overloaded, and I think the Blue Jays are overloaded with risk too.
How much does size have to do with it? Speaking of the Cardinals, like a guy like Carlos Martinez, like the people that see that have the concerns about him are because he's relatively short. I mean, taller than the average person, but shorter than the average pitcher. Does size have something to do with it? Do shorter pitchers have to overcompensate, or is that a myth?
I think that's mostly a myth. I think it's more about efficiency. You know, Mark Pryor's issue wasn't Mark Pryor was a very big guy who had an incredibly inefficient mechanics and a bad arm action as a result. Martinez is very efficient. I mean, if you go back into the history and you look at some of the hard throwers, I mean, Nolan Ryan isn't that big of a guy. You know, 6'1", 6'2". Pedro Martinez was, what, 5'9", 5'10"? I think a lot of it is about efficiency. Now, I think that because of the way pitchers are being taught, because of how the efficiency is being coached out of pitchers, size is kind of a compensation for that, but I don't think it's something that necessarily follows. I think it's just kind of an artifact of how pitchers are being taught. You know, I think as long as you're taller than 5'9", 5'10", you can do it. And you got, you know, maybe if you're 5'9", or 5'10", you know, I would argue that that's part of Lincecum's problem, is that he's a guy, you know, I think he's got the body of a 93, 94 guy, but he's employed a bunch of tricks to get him up to a 97, 98 guy. But, of course, now his body's fighting back and saying, no, you're like a 91,
you're a
90.
Right, right.
But,
yeah, you're a 90 guy, right, right. The body.
Right,
the
so,
body,
you know, but I would argue that Lincecum's problem isn't his size, it's his arm action. His arm action got him to a place where that his body just can't handle it.
Okay, so I want to get to you a couple more things before we let you go. You had just have an ebook out about Albert Pujols and his swing specifically. I've seen in places people talk about how Pujols' swing, regardless of everything else going on with him, Pujols' swing, and when he is healthy and when everything is going right, his strength seems to all be in balance. Can you talk about? I don't know if it's true or not. You've written the book. What's kind of your take on what Pujols, when healthy, does correctly?
Well, I think Albert Pujols, first of all, I think he's got a very, very mainstream swing, and that's one of the things I talk about at the beginning of the book, is I compare him up against, you know, Ortiz, Beltran, you know, those kinds of guys. And, you know, Pujols is not a freak. Pujols is a very middle-of-the-road kind of swing. His stance is a little wider, which lets him get lower, which kind of shrinks the strike zone, turns low balls into medium balls or high balls. But mechanically, Pujols has got a very, very standard swing. And I put the book together basically to give people a sense of what a good swing looks like, to give people a sense of what Pujols' swing looked like in the past, what made him great. And then one of the things I talk about is some of the things that he's gotten away from, you know, his stride. He's played around with his stride since at least 2011, and I think that's a big part of the problem. And I actually saw him play. I saw the Angels play Saturday or Sunday, and I don't think that Pujols is fixed, because I see variations in his stride. Sometimes he's doing a no stride. Sometimes he's doing a leg lift. And given the way his stance is, he cannot do a leg lift and still be able to hit off speed pitches. You know, effectively. But part of the things that I want to do is just talk about, this is what a good swing actually looks like. Because I was looking at this piece. It was a diamond demo of Harold Reynolds and Pujols talking hitting, and it's very obvious that Pujols doesn't have a good sense of what his swing looks like. You know, because Pujols is, you know, he's this is from 2011 when he broke his wrist. You know, they're talking hitting, and Pujols is demonstrating all this stuff that, you know, he's saying this is what you don't want to do, but if you look at Pujols' swing, the stuff that he says you don't want to do is what he actually does. You know, so some of this is I'm just trying to help out.
Yeah.
This is how I got into the whole hitting thing, was, you know, my dad tried to teach me the Charlie Lau stuff, and I read the Charlie Lau book, and I tried to copy what George Brett does in the book, and it didn't work. And I want, you know, I don't want kids to be in the position, I don't want my kids, I don't want your kids, I don't want anybody's kids to be in the same position that I was in, where you get these kind of myths and all these nonsense, you know, put forth, and it's even worse when a major leaguer is telling you the nonsense. You know, let's put together a comprehensive understanding of what a good swing actually looks like, of, you know, and let's pick one of the greatest hitters of the generation, if not all time. And, you know, and that's Pujols, and that's what the ebook looks like.
I remember the Charlie Lau stuff when I was a kid, and getting that book, and I was a kid. I wasn't any good anyway, but certainly it never felt right. But that became, I remember, you know, in the late 80s and early 90s, that was the way you were supposed to hit, was because Charlie Lau and George Brett.
Yeah, full extension at the point of contact. I remember my dad showing me these books, and, you know, head down, full extension at the point of contact. People called it, around here called it the power V. you know, I can remember sitting in the batting cage and trying to do it, and I just couldn't make it work, and I thought it just meant that I sucked. But the fact is that if you look at Brett's swing, that's not what Brett actually did. But because Brett was saying it, people believed it.
Yeah.
And that's the same thing with Pujols. Is because Pujols is saying it, people are believing it. But it's, you know,
that's not actually what he's doing.
No. And if he would actually read the book, he would I think he'd get a better understanding of the difference between what he's doing now and what he, you know, what really worked in the past. And I actually have a slight overlap with him, where some of the work that I did with Andres Torres, I did some talking with Torres about his stride, and he had a conversation with Pujols about it in 2011, and Pujols essentially stopped doing the leg lift in 2011. In the second half of 11, he started hitting again. But what Pujols is doing now is he's doing the leg lift again, and it doesn't work with his stance, and he's not going to be who he was doing the leg lift. It doesn't work with him.
Is that an injury compensation, or is that just a bad habit for people?
I don't, you know, I thought that it wouldn't surprise me if it was an injury compensation thing. Maybe it's just a bad habit now. Maybe it started off as an injury compensation thing. I mean, because what he actually, at the end of last season, for about 2 weeks, his numbers took off. And if you look at him, he started doing the no-stride pivot on the toe thing. Now, that's going to put a lot of strain on your left foot, especially if you've got plantar fasciitis. But the interesting thing is, for the last 2 or 3 weeks of the season, his numbers went right back up to, you know, he was hitting 350 with power and, you know, that kind of stuff. That says to me that he got out of it. You know, I don't know why he got out of it, but if he can get back to the doing the no stride, short stride, pivot on the toe, land on the toe kind of thing, I think his numbers could rebound. You know, there's going to be some regression because he's getting older, but I don't think there's any reason why he couldn't hit, you know, 300 with 30 or 40 home runs, but he has to get back to doing what he was doing in the past, this leg lift that he's doing, you know, that he's done. I call it his home run derby stride, because it's what he used to do in home run derbies, because it would give him a little more energy. You know, because when you're hitting a home run derby pitch, it's basically kind of a change up, and there's not as much energy in the ball, so you have to generate more energy yourself. But you can't use that home run derby stride in a live game setting, because it doesn't allow you to, because of how wide Pujols' stance is, it doesn't allow him to adjust to off speed pitches. It doesn't allow him to make the adjustments that he used to be able to make when he picks his foot up versus when he just kind of pivots on his toe and picks his heel up.
You know, I love talking with you about this stuff. I find this endlessly fascinating. Everyone that's been listening to this, where can they go to find more of your stuff and get the ebook and basically just see all the great stuff that I've seen?
Well, chrisoleary.com is a good starting point, and you can also follow me on Twitter at the pain guy. So I appreciate the interest.
Oh, of course. Sorry. Well, hey, thank you for your time, sir. I really appreciate it. And one last thing before I let you go, as a St. Louisan, how do you feel about this year's team?
I think they got a chance. It's just a question whether the pitching is going to hold up. I think they've got the depth. I think Matt Carpenter is a potential Hall of Famer. He reminds me of Boggs and Mattingly. Beltran leaving will create a hole, but I think, you know, they've got, you know, Peralta. At the pace that Peralta's on, he's going to hit 600 plus a run. So,
yeah, I think he hit more in one preseason game than I think we've seen from Cardinal shortstops in about 4 years. So I will take it.
I think they've got a good chance as long as things hold up. So
absolutely. All right. Well, hey, thank you for your time. I really appreciate it, and I'm sure I'd love to chat with you again once the season gets going.
Good deal. Thanks.
Take care. So thank you to Chris O'Leary. That was very, very smart stuff. I don't really I buy most of it. Is probably the best way to put it, but certainly he's done a lot of thinking about this, and I think it's fascinating that I always find there's a lot of value in the notion that sometimes the people that are close to this stuff actually don't understand it at all, and like Albert Pujols and George Brett may understand their swing less than someone can step back and take a closer look at it. So anyway, you can follow as you can go to chrisoleary.com and see his work there. You can also follow him on Twitter at ThePainGuy, T-H-E-P-A-I-N-G-U-Y. This has been the Willie Age Experience Podcast. The music is by the Sun Dogs. Please rate and review us on iTunes and so on. So Thursday's guest, I am elated to end the week with John Boyce, as associate editor at SB Nation and one of my favorite internet people. And if you know him, one of yours. I've already taped the podcast. It's going up Thursday. It is one big mutual internet hug. Anyway. I guess it would be better than it not being a non-mutual internet hug. That would be weird. That would be almost assault. Anyway, all right. I will talk to John and you tomorrow. Peace out.